Today at Reader's Corner, Mary Ellen Hannibal, author of The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken.
We're not saving nature fast enough. You know, there's tremendous habitat destruction all the time. Our roadways really bisect animal movement. A lot of animal movement goes north-south, and a lot of our biggest roadways go east-west. The Spine of the Continent is an effort to identify places where there's an important need to establish or restore connectivity. I think that what's standing in the way of all conservation is that more of us are not involved.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In a world besieged by climate change and encroaching development, the animals and plants that contribute to the biodiversity of our ecosystems are facing unprecedented danger. Each year, more species are becoming threatened. If nothing is done to reverse the trend, we may soon lose many of them forever. That's actually the premise of a new book, The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken, written by today's guest, Mary Ellen Hannibal. In her book, Ms. Hannibal describes how too many species are being stranded into small islands, areas cut off from each other by urban sprawl, miles of cattle fences, and a crisscrossing grid of deadly highways. The Spine of the Continent focuses on the science behind an ambitious wildlife conservation effort to create linked, protected wilderness areas extending from the Yukon all the way south to Mexico. The Rocky Mountains and the diverse natural areas they support provide a foundation for a cycle of life that has played out for thousands of years. The Spine is a grassroots conservation effort of top scientists, conservation activists, and concerned citizens dedicated to creating corridors for wildlife from Canada to Mexico. Ms. Hannibal is a 2012 National Association of Science Writers Award winner and a 2011 Alicia Patterson Foundation Fellow. She joins us today by phone from San Francisco. Mary Ellen Hannibal, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. I love your introduction because you hit on so many very important dimensions of this whole project in your introduction. Thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, and it's such a fascinating project, and I assume one that has so much success ahead of it. But let's start at the very beginning. First of all, if you could elaborate a bit on my very brief introduction, what is the Spine of the Continent movement, and why is it so significant?
So the Spine of the Continent, when I give a presentation in real time or in real life, I show this map of North America. It's a beautiful map made by Raven Map Company, because on this map of North America, Bob, you can really see that the Rocky Mountains take up, you know, a huge portion of our continent, almost half of the continent. This is a pathway down which the original peoples came onto our continent, and even before that, plants and animals migrated onto this continent in successive waves. And the Native American peoples, certain tribes, have called this the People's Way. And this is a passageway that is still kind of like an animal lifeline highway almost, that's still functioning very much today. And so that's sort of the problem that we're facing now, is that we don't have so many other places on our continent where there's the same freedom of movement of wildlife. So the Spine of the Continent is an initiative started by Michael Soule, who's the most famous scientist you've never heard of until now. And he was Paul Ehrlich's first graduate student at Stanford back in the 70s. And they started to look at genetic populations of different species. And at the same time, while they're examining genetics of populations, E.O. Wilson, who we all know, and Robert MacArthur published something called The Theory of Island Biogeography. And in short surmise, The Theory of Island Biogeography posits that the smaller the island and the farther away from a mainland, the faster the species on it will go extinct. And Wilson commented in this theory, this paper, which eventually became a book, that since human development is making islands out of natural areas, conservation ought to look at this problem. So Michael Soule started to look at this problem very carefully, and so did many other scientists like Paul Ehrlich and Jared Diamond. And over the decades that really were the beginnings of conservation biology, they really codified that even a place as large as Yellowstone National Park or Glacier National Park is not large enough to keep populations vibrant and healthy. So one example is the grizzly bears in Yellowstone. There's about 660 of them. But if those grizzly bears can't meet and mingle and intermingle genetically with other populations of grizzly bears, then they will go extinct. So there's tons of grizzly bears relatively to us up in the Canadian wilderness. But between the Canadian wilderness and Yellowstone, there's a lot of huge areas that have no grizzly bears. So how are we going to connect those grizzly bear populations so that that population can stay vibrant? And the Spine of the Continent is an effort to identify places like this sort of grizzly highway that we could imagine where there's an important need to establish or restore connectivity. It also looks at where is the connectivity that's going on now most important looking into the future. So climate change adds a whole different thing onto this concept because plants and animals are moving poleward as the climate is changing. And here in North America, that means they're moving north. They have to be able to get where they're going or else they will be severely even more troubled than they already are.
I guess to give listeners a chance to get inside your thinking here and the thinking of the Spine of the Continent movement, I noticed in your book, and I had a personal experience about 3 or 4 years ago, my wife and I decided to drive up to Banff National Park. And we're on these highways up there, and there's these overpasses. And it took us about a day or two to figure out what was going on because they looked like they were all planted. And we couldn't figure out, well, you know, what kind of an overpass is that? It's trees, it's brush, it's whatever. Well, as you point out in your book, I guess you might call that a microscopic example of what Banff National Park is trying to do to let animals move freely through the park. And again, it's a very small example, but isn't that in a sense what you're talking about on a massive scale from Canada to Mexico?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I'm glad that you brought that up because those Banff overpasses are really, they're very progressive. They're really ahead of the curve. They're ahead of the rest of us on dealing with the fact that our roadways really bisect animal movement. A lot of animal movement goes north-south, as the Spine of the Continent does, and a lot of our biggest roadways go east-west. So if you and I want to cross the road, you know, we look both ways and we cross, and so animals try to do that too, but they get hit by cars. So when I started to research this book, Bob, one of the subjects I did not really feel like that enthusiastic about investigating was roadkill. But as I did get it further into this book, I began to see roadkill as an excellent and very interesting dimension of conservation because it's something we can all really understand. I can understand that if a roadway bifurcates, say, grizzly habitat, those grizzlies are going to have a hard time getting across the road without getting hit by a car. And if we build an overpass or an underpass for them to use, then we're helping them and we can coexist. And that's what we're looking for, coexisting with these wild animals so that they can do their thing and we can do ours.
My guest today is Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's the author of The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. You actually did some traveling along what might one day become the Spine of the Continent, did you not?
I did. I did quite a lot of traveling, and there's a lot of different issues. So up in looked at grizzly bears a lot up in Canada. In Bozeman in Montana, I went with a field biologist who studied pika for many years, and that was really fascinating and fun. Pika are these little rabbit relatives that live at the very top of mountains, and they're kind of a poster child for climate change because other plants and animals can go north or upslope to get a cooler climate, but they have nowhere to go. So there's a lot of interesting information around pika there. In Colorado, I delved into the world of hunters and elk and some wolf issues. And in Arizona and Mexico, I delved into the jaguar and into some of the issues with border crossings. So I had a great time.
I guess that would be really, really exciting. Can we put a time frame on when this thing moved out of Michael Soule's brain and became a strategy to be implemented involving a lot of other groups and organizations in wildlife management and conservation biology. Where did this all start, and where do you, how do you describe where we are today?
So Michael Soule started something called the Wildlands Project with Dave Foreman. So you have Michael Soule, who's this blue ribbon scientist, very straight ahead, equation and mathematical formula oriented person. And he teams up with this, you know, really voluble activist. And they map the entire continent with important wildways, which were, I don't know if they called them wildways back then. But that got to be too big of a project. And then they focused on these important mega linkages, and they created maps. This is before the age of satellites and GIS. Well, we had satellites, but we weren't using them to get the exact, you know, latitude and longitude of where things really are. But eventually, these maps have become geo-referenced. So it was a grassroots kind of environmental movement. There's probably for about 20 years, there's been more and more nonprofits that have joined onto this all up and down the spine of the continent. One of the most significant ones is something called Yellowstone to Yukon, Y2Y. Many people have heard of Y2Y, and that organization is very effective, and they put their arms around a big chunk of land that goes north into Canada. Another one that is equally vibrant is called the Sky Island Alliance, and that's down at the southern end of the spine of the continent, going from Mexico up through Arizona and New Mexico. But where I see the real gains of the Spine of the Continent initiative now, Bob, is actually in the state and federal government's understanding and embracing of the idea of landscape connectivity. So the Western Governors Association, and Idaho is part of that, so is California where I live, they have a corridor initiative in which they're having all the states, the Western states, are mapping the important linkages in each of our states and making sure that they're all mapped in the same way and that the databases are all sort of speaking the same language. And all of these databases have at their center these original maps made by Michael Soule and Dave Foreman, and the people that they were working with are part of those databases. And then on the federal government side, there's something called the Landscape Conservation Cooperatives, which are these just enormous bioregionally defined organizations, also dedicated to the same idea of getting this connectivity identified and protected. And especially with the landscape conservation cooperatives, this idea of connectivity extends not just beyond even the landscape to we need to talk to each other across jurisdictions, state, county, federal, nonprofit, tribal. We need all the players, all the stakeholders on the land talking to each other in order to really get this done. And I see the government really embracing the idea and moving forward with it. I think where we lack is that the general public doesn't know the connectivity concept. And in many cases, the general public has just a hugely important role to play in connectivity.
Well, sooner or later, I would think that that general public will have to apply the pressure on governmental bodies when they move from talking about it. And it sounds to me like what's going on now, you know, you're at a level where you're doing a lot of talking about it, but you talk in your book, for example, about cattle grazing and fencing, and wow, when you get into some of those issues, you're going to need the, I won't say the heavy hand of government, but let's say the authoritative hand of government to step in and decide, make some decisions that have lasting impact, wouldn't you think?
Yes, and I think you actually really put your finger on it when you say that the general public really needs to get involved in these issues. Something like the issue of cattle grazing on public lands is this incredibly entrenched, polarized conflict, but it's actually a conflict that is undertaken amongst a fairly small number of people. And there's many dimensions to the issue, and there's kind of no right answer or wrong answer to it. But as we go forward into the future with climate change, what we really need to prioritize is the resilience of our landscapes. So when a large weather events come through, like Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast or big fires that happen here in the West, what we need is a resilient landscape. And that means we need a lot of native vegetation that has very deep roots into the ground. We need healthy waterways. we need a full suite of species on the landscape because the species are what keep the landscape resilient. Something like cattle grazing intercepts the species vibrance on a landscape because the cattle eat all of the forage all the way down to the ground and nobody else has any habitat. So we need to get into the discussion with, hey, yeah, you have your priorities with your cattle grazing and your ranching. And by the way, at 7 billion people and counting, we need our cattle to help feed this huge population that we have on the earth. But we need to bring biodiversity to the table because we all need it to help us as climate change encroaches.
So you're not the only one that's going to take off and move around this area and try to get a better definition of what the spine of the continent should look like. Toward the end of your book, you point out the work of John Harris, or I don't know whether he's started yet or not, but apparently he's actually going to go on foot. Not entirely. I think it said that he might have to lift off into an airplane to get over a couple of areas and down into Mexico. But help us understand what the objective of that particular hike is, I guess you could call it.
So this is something called Trek West, which is to be undertaken by John Davis, who is one of the very earliest founders with Michael Soule of the Wildlands Network, which is now called that, along with his mother. And his mother was a big environmental activist who died last year. So he was just a kid when this all started, and the other members who started this organization were, you know, in their 40s and 50s, but he was really young in his very early 20s, and he's been an activist his whole life. So his mother became ill with cancer probably about 2 years ago, and in her honor, he physically traversed the East Coast seaboard from the bottom of Florida all the way up through Canada on foot and by boat and bicycle. And he called that Trek East. And what he said he was doing is ground-truthing what his elders and what these brainiac scientists have told us about connectivity. He said, I wanted to see for myself, what's it like to move across the landscape, and can you do it? And he stopped in places along the way and highlighted issues that different species have in different places, where there's panthers or black bears that can't get across an important conjunction because there's a shopping mall in the way, and where just small mammals get killed by the scores because they get hit by cars. And now he's starting the spine of the continent starting at the end of January, and you can follow him by looking at Trek West online. There's a Trek West website, and he will traverse the entire spine of the continent, and he will stop and highlight different issues and different creatures along the way, much as I did in my book.
Mary Ellen, what's the greatest obstacle that lies before advocates of the spine of the continent?
Well, you know, I'll just open up the question a little bit even further, widen it. You know, when I was researching this book, I'm really asking myself, is this really working? And what's in the way? And by the way, lots of people who work in conservation are very self-reflective people, and they really want to save nature, and they often sit down and say, what are we not doing right? What are we not doing right? We're not saving nature fast enough. Because, in fact, we're not saving nature fast enough. You know, there's tremendous development and habitat destruction all the time. But I have to say, Bob, that at the end of the day, I think they're not doing anything wrong. I think they're doing everything right. I think they're wonderful people. They're all sorts of different kinds of people. I followed, you know, Sherry Tippy, who's a hairdresser who relocates beaver. Janae Brune, who's a waitress, who told the truth about what happened to this incredibly rare jaguar macho bee. People who are brave, and they're fearless, and they just love nature, and they do the right thing. And I think that what's standing in the way of all conservation is that more of us are not involved. Now, how do we get involved, and how do we make a change? So that would be another question. And my next book that I'm researching right now is about citizen science, which is a very broad term for regular people contributing to scientific research. And it's a burgeoning field, and there's all sorts of opportunities. You guys, you can go right now and go online and find something called iNaturalist.org, and you can start taking pictures with your iPhone of species in your backyard that potentially could help conservation. And I think that just finding anything that you like to do, if you like to be outside and help remove invasive species, or if you want to get on the phone and help you know, the Center for Biological Diversity, get people to understand about endangered species. Anything anybody can do helps. And that's what I think is in the way. The rest of us need to be involved.
You're listening to Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's the author of The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. One of the things I found interesting about your book is the way you would take detours from the specific subject of the spine of the continent and help us understand better how we got where we are today. And one of the things that you gave us a lesson on in this book is conservation biology as a discipline, which really didn't form until maybe the mid-1980s. I wonder if you could help us understand just what that means, conservation biology, and the role that it is playing in this project. How does this all come about?
I found this to be really fascinating because I guess I assumed when I started this project that conservation biology had always been around because I've heard the phrase, you know, for a long time. But what exactly is it? So when I started to really investigate what is conservation biology and how did it come about, I did discover, as you mentioned, that it really did not become a discipline until like 1986, and it was Michael Soule who declared it a discipline, and he wrote the first textbooks, and he convened the first conferences. But the significance of conservation biology is sort of like analogous to the birth of medicine. So you think of medicine is science, really. It's the science of the human body and health. And then medicine focuses on healing the body and healing these mechanisms that are scientifically based, our bodies. Well, conservation biology is like medicine for nature. And it really came about because of these guys, Michael Soule, Paul Ehrlich, E.O. Wilson, Jared Diamond, noticing nature is in trouble. Nature is sick in a lot of places, and we need to help heal it. And then as these decades have gone by, so 86, it's only like 30 years at the most, we've gotten into worse shape. We're getting sicker because of climate change and habitat destruction. Now, another really interesting thing I think about conservation biology is that even as much as medicine does, it really intersects with our social realities. It's really part of how, you know, land use decisions cut all the way to the core of our vibrance as a nation economically. So the science has gotten very, very refined, but the social side of it is still needed to really apply it. We have hospitals everywhere, right, for people, but we need to have the equivalent of groups of people helping to save nature everywhere.
Well, you've already mentioned the PICA, but you address a number of issues that really bring the importance and the need for this Spine of the Continent project to life. The beaver is one. How does the beaver relate to the connectivity of wildlands issue?
When I started to research the beaver, I was really in danger of writing a whole book about beaver because it was such a mind blower to me to read the history of, this goes back to what you mentioned before, how we got here. How did our landscapes get degraded? Arguably, it started before this, but it's certainly a big moment in the degradation of our landscapes happened through the fur trade. And the fur trade went on for 300 years and really is how we established this nation. Because just as we use oil today as our natural resource that we really depend on at the heart of our commerce, this was what beaver pelts were in the 1700s. And it became this just gigantic commerce that went on for hundreds of years. But what happened is people would trap out beaver in one place, starting in New England, just completely decimate the beaver, and then move west to the next beaver population. Now, beaver, when beaver are on your waterways, everything works differently than it does if they're not. So beaver create dams, and they slow the flow of water down. Slowing it down cleans the water because the sediment goes to the bottom and creates a more hospitable home for lots of different kinds of fish than can live in fast-moving water. So you have more fish, and you have more insects, and more amphibians, more reptiles, more small mammals, more birds. Everybody comes on by to live where beaver dams are. They change the hydrology. They change the water system everywhere, and they change it all for the better. They're part of creating nature just the same way as photosynthesis is. And we haven't really paid attention to that. And people are still not really studying it. And there's so much to the life history of every animal in this way. So this is another thing about extinction. You take these animals out, it's not just sad. It is sad, but it's also a tremendous loss to science and to knowledge. How do beaver know how to do this? Why do they do it?
Your subtitle says it all. The most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. And obviously it is, because it involves land and ownership of land. I guess what comes to mind for me is, to pull this off, you really will need a political Michael Soule, a popular Western governor, a federal official. Is there anyone out there? Is there somebody who's willing to stand up at this point and take this on the public side of the issue, in state legislatures, in state capitals?
Unfortunately, I don't see that. There's a state senator on the East Coast who has proposed corridor legislation, and he's really behind doing this, but he hasn't been successful. It would be fantastic if one of the Western governors would really step up to the plate. But I did see, when I was researching this book, sort of what they're up against, because there is a sort of this old standoff between the states and the federal government, and the states want to do it themselves. They don't want the federal government to say, you have to legislate corridor protection. But you know what? I think it would be wonderful if there was a politician, but we don't need to wait for that person. A really wonderful example of how this stuff can go forward and really get accomplished is the Path of the Pronghorn. So the Path of the Pronghorn is a single migration route of one herd of antelope in Wyoming. And they make the same migration every year. It's at least 6,000 years that they've been doing it. And a couple of biologists from the Wildlife Conservation Society, who were studying them, this herd for another reason, noticed that there was this huge uptick in mortality of these animals around the Jonah infill drilling fields. This is where fracking was invented. And the reason was because there was just a lot more traffic there, and the animals were being killed. So Joel Berger and his then wife, Kim Berger, went to Niffy Hamilton, who was the supervisor of the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and they said, let's have this be the first national corridor in the United States. We'll protect this corridor under Forest Service rules. And Niffy thought this was a great thing to do. And now this is something you don't hear a lot, Bob, is a Forest Service or a Bureau of Land Management official actually really taking a big conservation challenge and going with it. But this woman did it. The first thing she did is go to Washington to get a national corridor protection for the Path of the Pronghorn, and she got nowhere. So she came back to her state, Wyoming, and they all started working together. The scientists, the officials from the Forest Service, they were joined by the Bureau of Land Management and some of the oil companies. But what they had to do really was go around almost door to door and have community meetings and tell the people who lived along the Path of the Pronghorn, did you know that this ancient migration pathway is going through your backyard? And people didn't know it. Suddenly you have people really caring. And the Path of the Pronghorn is a grassroots, but hands held across all jurisdictions to get this done. And I think that's the way that we can keep moving forward until we get a politician who is brave enough to take a big stand.
Well, that's a perfect way of summing it up, Mary Ellen. We sure appreciate your coming onto the show. The name of the book, The Spine of the Continent, The Most Ambitious Wildlife Conservation Project Ever Undertaken, by Mary Ellen Hannibal. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner, Mary Ellen.
Thank you. I'm very grateful for you having me on your show.
Next week, Stefan Bechtel, author of Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.